When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome back to The Drop-In, everybody. This season, we've brought you guests from all backgrounds and careers in the world of football because we're trying to show you the different corners of football and uncover how it's run, what it looks like, and how it feels to be a part of it. Today's guest has one of the most fascinating careers of all, and she will lift the lid on how football is run. Lisa Klaveness is the president of Norway's Football Association. She was a footballer herself with over 70 caps for her national side. She was a technical director then for both the men's and the women's teams between 2018 and 2022. So she was close with players like Ada Hegerberg and Erling Haaland, as well as Martin Ødegaard. Now she's running to be elected to UEFA's executive committee. But interestingly, there's one spot that is reserved for a woman and she hasn't chosen to contest that. Ever since her speech at FIFA's Congress in Doha this time last year, she's been known as an administrator who's willing to speak truth to power, and she's made a name for herself as someone who shakes up the status quo. I wanted to ask her about the major challenges that football faces over the next 10 years, and just how UEFA and other football governing bodies can restore fans' trust after so many betrayals in recent years. But I wanted to start with that hugely significant moment at the FIFA Congress last year. I think the first way that I became aware of you as a football administrator was from your speech in Doha about a year ago, where you spoke about some of the challenges around the World Cup, and then there was a sort of attempted smackdown by Hassan Al-Thwaiti. How did you feel going into that speech, and what did you make of the reaction?
Yeah, it was an extreme week, of course, an extreme experience. You know, I was 3 weeks into my presidency. I worked as a technical director in Norway the 4 years before, so I came from the sport and literally from the field and the locker rooms, being the leader of the men's and the women's top football in Norway. So I did not know the room. I did not know the people. I came in with some convictions and also you know, a clear message from my own members. They wanted me to have a critical speech towards FIFA for the award of the World Cup and how they have handled it. So I went in with and I knew that it was controversial because I got. The clear impression in the days going up, and many people came to me and gave me different input, you know, some friendly, some not so friendly, but I realized that this is, it's not wanted, and it's risky. From maybe they want to advise me that I will make a fool out of myself for being politically isolated. And I'm married to a woman, and this was also a case in a country where this is not legal, and also being a female leader. And so I of course felt uneasy and very focused on delivering this message. But you have some, it's not so often in life, you know, that you have something that you would do anyway, you know, that no matter what, you would still do it. So this is one of those things, because it had gone on for so long time in Norway. It had been a debate that had pulled the Norwegian football and international football down for so many years. And the game I love and my country loves. So the motivation was, you know, 100%. So that's sort of a good place to be. But of course, I felt that was extreme, and I felt exposed. But when I held the speech, it was a very clear feeling of doing my job. You know, this is my responsibility to do.
In 2010, World Cups were awarded by FIFA in unacceptable ways with unacceptable consequences. Human rights, equality, democracy, the core interests of football were not in the starting 11 until many years later. These basic rights were pressured on to the field as substitutes, mainly by outside voices. FIFA has addressed these issues, but there is still a long way to go.
Afterwards, I was a bit shocked with, because you know how many Congress have you seen, you know, I've never seen a Congress before. So I was just, you know, in the room. That was more than enough for me, you know, that this is a room of people I don't know, mostly male presidents that don't like me, I guess now. But then it was, you know, enormous response from all over the world, Africa and South America and everywhere actually. So it was both. Afterwards, it was, you know, the full range of, you know, both that I got some opponents and people that felt that this was not the right time and place and activistic, and they disagreed very strongly. And also on the other side, very inspiring conversation with gay people from Africa and, you know, female sport reporters from South America, people I did not know listened to this. So it was a very special experience that I will never forget.
Was the feeling in the room, could you feel the atmosphere drop? That was the impression I just could imagine. I could imagine kind of being in your shoes and sort of standing up there and being like, I've got to do this, and and feeling it, you know?
Yeah. It was not like this wedding, you know. It was it was very silent, quiet room. And I knew that on beforehand, I had some discussions with some of the administrators in FIFA that they wanted me maybe to sit in my place and deliver the speech, because it was so, as they said, far up to the stage. And then I got very annoyed and angry, because I knew that this was, of course, an appeal. I had to look people in the eye, and that was good for me that they went so far, because then I got energy from feeling that I was obstructed. But then I was also very concerned that I have to be ready when my name is called, so that they don't have to use time waiting for me on that long, you know, since it's so far, you know. And then when they called my name, I was not ready. So I felt that it took forever for me to go to the stage. So that I felt that I was, you know, in the way, you know, that now everyone has to wait for me. So it was very interesting from a, you know, freedom of expression point of view, looking back at it, that it can be very, you know, extreme, or the push can be very heavy if against speeches and to raise your voice, even though you're allowed through democratic mechanisms, you sort of maneuver past very many obstructions. And in the end, you know, you have to be very careful to have your self-confidence, you know, intact, because it's not so easy.
What a fascinating metaphor, if that's the phraseology that they used about thinking about you sitting in your place. I mean, what an amazing concept for you to be one of the very few women in there, and then to say, oh, well, we need you to sit in your place. that is the impression, of course, that we have of FIFA and of the governing bodies, I think, of football, is that it is just a bunch of very similar looking older men. Is that a fair impression?
Yeah, you know, from an outside perspective, this is how it looks. And this is, of course, how it also looked for me, you know, then. But I love people. I don't like stereotype, but you know, everyone are different. We know this, you know, when you get to know people, they come from where they come from. You know, some are from Azerbaijan, some are from England, even though they're men over 50, most of them, but they're still fascinating people, of course. So, and I don't know all these people, but now that I've known some, this is not the problem for me, that the you know, for me personal, but it is a big problem that the structure is so that most, it will be like this. And it's to me, very many great people work in football, and FIFA from administrative level have a too bad reputation, because there are great people working there, of course, or else it wouldn't be this brand World Cup over and over. You know, it's a big thing, and it's a monopoly that would not have survived if it was not some sort of logistic very high quality. But it's some really big issues with the governance, with the culture, I think. And it's also, I think, a culture of a bit fear. I feel that the leaders are very insecure. They don't want to be clear with opinions, because then you can lose championships. I don't know if that's the truth, if you will lose championships. But this is very easily said. It comes very early, you know, in conversations with, you know, strong leaders, or you know, people with much responsibility. So to me, coming from the place I come from and with my personality, I feel that it's, you know, sort of something that it's not satisfying. These are not good conversations, you know. So to me, it becomes a very big issue to try to speak about it then. Because is it so that if you have a reasonable objection to something totally different, you will lose the opportunity to have a championship to your country? I don't think so, you know. And if it is so, of course, that is, you know, something that we all have to fight. So I would say I don't know if this is because there are men over 50, it's probably not, but it is a culture of business as usual. Keep your head down, wait for your turn. And this goes for everyone, not just female presidents, you know. I think I just, we might disturb it a bit, but and it's not nice to disturb things, you know. You want to respect cultures, and I do respect cultures, but I do think it's important to have a wave of change, because we're going into a time now with very much geopolitical distress, de-anchoring of deglobalization. It's so many, you know, outside big issues coming, that if we're going to be afraid and insecure leaders in football, I think football in itself would be you know, in very big distress.
So you're saying that leaders of FAs in this context are nervous to speak up because they feel like then they might not get the chance to, for example, host the Euros in years to come. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, it's very often said in conversations that we should lie lower in a totally different case. One thing if it was something to do with the Euros, you know, but a totally different case, or else it might affect, you know, the councils or the leading bodies, you know, view of your application. And I have no indication that this is actually happening, that these are connected. And you would think, you know, in this, you know, it's the biggest and most professional sport in the world, that this would be very easy to separate from each other, and that you have checks and balances that these are not connected, that you can discuss one case without, you know, your own. But it's very often said, it's at least, I don't want to, you know, refer to any specific conversation because these are colleagues, but it's very often referred to as be careful so that it does not, you know, affect your application to Euros or your World Cups or, you know. So to me, that is fascinating. I've never worked as a judge, you know, I've never heard most systems are very aware of the opposite, you know, that it should not be connected in that way. And I don't know if it's a reality, but this culture of fear and insecurity amongst leaders, I think is an important thing to address.
Is that connected then to the like old boys network, we call it here, vibes, you know, where everyone kind of knows each other and so then everyone's a bit nervous to speak out of turn or to do something that the group doesn't like? Is that what this is about?
To me, it's also not so the presidency and the candidacy and the voting power. It's not so connected with the country and the federation. It's not so clear link, which it actually is. You know, I feel that I work on behalf of Norway and my members, and that I try to confer with them as often as I can on what to do in cases, not case by case, of course, but generally discuss it openly through media, because you have to, how else, you know, it's a country, so I cannot call everyone. Of course, you have delegates, but I've realized that this is, I think many countries can vote for many things without even debating in their own country. So I do think it gets more and more personal, you know, this guy likes this person. This person likes this application. This person does not like that. This person seemed very engaged to human rights, maybe then. So I think this is a big part of the problem, actually, or the challenge.
And with all this in mind, what you're doing at the moment is you're standing to be on UEFA's executive committee. Can you explain for us in a sort of simple way what that is and what that does?
Yeah, it's the board. Yeah, no, it's the deciding board of UEFA, which is, you know, the European deciding body of football. So it's you know, quite an ordinary board, actually, of the decision maker. So it's the top elected leadership of European football, also England, Norway. So it's a big deal. But of course, maybe how real, you know, the decisions are taken in the boardroom, I don't know. But you know, formally, this is the deciding body of European football.
And what's the process for getting into it?
So it's the president's, it's 20 people in the board. It's one female position. It's presidents that are elected, but it's one female position where you don't have to be a president, only female. And this is the position I did not want to run for, so I go for an open position. And now 7 people in the board of 20 is now in a re-election, 7 men. And I will run for those 7 positions. We're 11 men and me running for these positions, and it's presidents voting. So it's one president, one vote. So and it's a secret votation system. So even though your country might, you know, have a debate where they want female leadership in, or Germany or Belgium, you would never really know what your president, and maybe the link is not really clear either. So I'm told that it's not a very big chance that I will come in. You know, I'm pretty new, and I often get I hear that, you know, people wait for 10 years and, you know, stay in line, sort of. But this case is bigger than me, you know, and I feel that it's very critical and urgent to have female president in. You know, not ever has a female president run for candidacy even, and this is the biggest sport for women in Europe.
So that would mean if you were to win, then Lisa, it would double the number of women on the committee. You'd join Laura McAllister from Wales, which would be a huge change in the level of representation, but still very far off any kind of parity in terms of gender on the committee. I saw that Ada Hegerberg has supported your bid to join the committee, and she's someone I'm assuming you know very well, given that I believe you were responsible for helping persuade her to rejoin the Norway squad. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I also played with Ada. She's much younger than me, but when I was, you know, in my finishing year, she was, you know, a teenager, a talented one, very talented one, very, you know, competitive, strong also back then. So I know her from the playing days, and then I quit. I also worked as a TV pundit, commentating men and women's football, and so I had all these games commentating her game. So I know her from before. So when she quit the national team, I was actually working as a TV pundit, commentating her games through the Norwegian state channel. So I kept contact with her when she quit. I felt sorry for her, I've been also outside of the national team for a period, and I know how a federation can be, you know, one body for you and one, you know, intimidating. So I kept contact with her and sort of supported her. I saw the perspective she tried to get people to see, you know, and so we kept sort of contact. And when I started as a technical director, I just had one aim, actually, and to keep the conflict level so that the federation would not stand in the way for her career, you know, because it can be very big, you know, if you build it, you know. So that was the aim, to keep contact so that she could perform and feel that she had friendly voices, you know, in the leadership of the, because we are connected to Norway, the country. It's how it is. It's unavoidable. It's a monopoly. So we managed to keep this good contact, text messages and calls, and just in a normal, friendly. But and when the years went by, I felt that at some point she was ready to come back. I did not feel that I persuaded her per se, but of course I never hid the fact that we of course wanted her back and that we would be ready if she wanted to have these discussions. But she's not a person that wants pressure, or she has clear mind, she has clear opinion. So it's her own work, you know. At some point she wanted to come back, she wanted to see if we had changed some things she was concerned with, and it was a great feeling when she decided to come back. Of course we want the best players in our national team.
It's a big vote of confidence for a sense of progress as well for Norway, I would say.
Yeah, it is very big difference between men and women's football in the world and also in Norway. And I've also been a player where you don't want that division. I have a brother also playing. Why should he get, you know? I train so much more than him. You know, I love the principle angle at it and the strong voices of change. I also know now from a federation standpoint, we don't sit with the political key to change it. You know, it's unfortunately when we have a market where Erling Haaland is worth billions and Norwegian crowns, so hundreds of millions euros, and female players are worth, you know, maybe some 100,000. It's not up to one leader to change everything or one player. But we can accelerate something, and Ada has accelerated something in Norwegian Federation by giving her strong opinion and being a strong person. She's always trying to be there for kids, for example, if we want her to send videos or to come to arrangements. So she has this integrated in her body that she wants to change. She has a political integration of this, so she can drive changes, but... We continuously have discussions of things she thinks should be better, and I agree. But you know, it's also complex, as you know. You know, the difference, you know, are very embedded in the world and the global football. But very inspiring to have these kinds of players, and we're lucky we have several actually that are very into not just their career but the Lionesses as well. You know, we have some of those on the women's side now, and it's great. I think people that say politics and football should be very separated, they have never been discriminated and kept away from their sport, you know. So I do for female players, this is not a natural sentence to say.
Yeah, so it sounds as though, because strikes and protests have been going on a lot across women's international football recently, we've been talking about it on our women's football show up front recently, Spanish national team, France, of course, including Wendy Renard, and Canada as well. So you think that this is an important step, even though we cannot change where we are as a world?
These are important steps. You know, coming from the federation, I feel sometimes it's heavy on federation's chest, because this is something media, sponsors, audience, schools, you know, everyone has to, you know, look themselves in the mirror and say, you know, do we acknowledge that we are now, you know, strengthening a discriminating system by sending 95% men on our screens, for example. Sponsorships would say that we want gender equality and they go on the federation or on the club, but do they give equally, you know, the sum? Of course, federation should be ready to change. It has been conserving the changes, no, or the differences. So I welcome these waves from the female national teams. But it's also important that it's not just, you know, paralyzing federations because they are not able to solve it themselves. They are not. So it has to be a critical mass of people realizing the urgency of this matter.
Yeah, speaking about one of your men's players as well, does it make you proud to see someone like Martin Ødegaard do so well in the Premier League? And what do you make of his development as a player at Arsenal, no longer playing as so much of a 10, for example?
Yeah, you know Martin has, since he played in the top league in Norway when he was 14, and he made his debut for the national team when he was 16. So he was, you know, this child star in Norway, you know, this prodigy. We hadn't seen, you know, such a calm player with such, you know, great technical abilities, but also playing mind ever, actually. So he has, you know, he has lived with great pressure and expectations since he was just a little boy. Always handled it with grace and grit. Always been, you know, this silent leader. So I must say, you know, that he makes me very proud on so many levels, almost on his behalf also, you know, that the way he has, you know, conducted and carried himself through this also. So he's a great person and a great leader for the Norwegian national team. Also one that tries to always bridge things, thinking about the team, not himself. So a great, great genius player, but also, you know, a remarkable person.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Let's talk a bit more about UEFA generally and about your thoughts on it as a federation, I guess. I mean, you have seen, of course, the stand that they took on the Super League. But how do you feel about the lack of regulation on who can own football's biggest clubs in Europe? Because I saw on your pamphlets, delivering competitive balance is like a huge thing for you, but also, you know, for the sport of football in the coming years.
Yeah, it's such a big issue, you know, and I think it's the pulse of football in the world, and European football, of course, but also in the world. Even though the American system is different than the European, it's coming from the European pulse. So, you know, so I think the reality of a small local team being able to travel all the way up, you know, even though you know it does not happen very often, but that is the pulse, you know, that it's actually connected to Erling Haaland or Martin Ødegaard. They can come from small Norwegian clubs, and they did not play in big academies. They came from small Norwegian clubs, and now they're playing Champions League football. So that is the pulse of European football, to have independent strong federations with independent strong leagues, where, you know, everyone can make it to the top if they want it enough. And of course it's also about money, of course, but it's possible. And of course this has moved more and more away from that, you know, structurally, one step at a time. And I guess the Super League sort of helped the political discussion and make us remember where we're coming from. And actually, you know, sort of triggered the awareness that we have to protect this game. But it's a very important that we now, even if the one attack from the Super League group has been put down, I think this will come again and again. It is a push to, you know, gather the money at the top. And I think a very important step for all countries, also the English FA, even though they are big and they have the Premier League, I think most wise leaders, and Debbie Hewitt, which is the president of the English FA, she is a wise leader. She also sees this, that it's very important that we have structures and we have decisions that, you know, build strong federations, strong leagues, and triple down effects that make it very clear that when you earn money in this one league, how does it support the ecosystem even more than it does today? So it is difficult to regulate away owners. It is very difficult, because then law, and I'm a lawyer, so I like law, I like systems, but it is limits to how far you can go to regulate out of a political, cultural problem. So yes, we need regulation that has, you know, real teeth, but in the end I think it's just as much about politics and that we have a critical mass of people protecting the game. Because yeah, you can have regulation saying that this and this owner cannot own this and this club, but you will find ways around it. So of course in Norway and Germany we have membership owned clubs. So that is of course a structure, and it's pros and cons with all systems, but I do think it's important going ahead to have democratic. They have the democracy higher up on the agenda for clubs. But rather than limiting this and this owner, I think the most important thing is to think from the other end, you know, how to have the trickle-down effects more efficiently, how to have strong federation, independent federation, how to bundle TV rights so that the leagues, national leagues, are stronger, so that you don't have to choose between Champions League and your national league. How can you also bundle this with female or see it in connection with the women's side? These things, I think, will come more and more in the next decade.
Because emotionally, fans, of course, might think that they would like to have decent ethical owners. But then if someone turns up from Saudi Arabia and would like to run the club, then really people are excited about winning the league potentially. So it's a big challenge.
It is
emotionally
a big challenge.
Versus
it is if you have, you know, open for ownerships, you know, it's difficult to have like a moral. Of course, you need systems where you know filter away criminality and these regulation needs to have teeth as well, you know, and we've seen that it doesn't really always have that. So then they're just sitting on the paper. But in the end, we also need clubs to, you know, We don't need systems where we just conserve one club as the strongest as well. We also need a system where people can invest in a new club and you know, change the table a bit. So it's pros and cons. And I do think, you know, with state owner, when state-owned clubs are coming more and more and states are getting closer and closer to the sport, we need more and more and stronger regulations, with the leadership of football having arm-length distance to the states. That is a problem, I think, that these are now around the owners and the states are too close to the boardrooms, and they, you know, money is such a strong, you know, temptation in itself, you know, that we need, you know, boards where, you know, the sport is well represented. The other aspects of the sport should be, you know, balanced and just as well represented, which is not really the case now. So it's a difficult case, but I do think it's possible to protect the game when we look at it from the other angle, you know, how to, you know, preserve the ecosystem and how to have systems where the trickle-down effect and, you know, the solidarity of the whole pyramid is so strong. Then at least you will have owners that, you know, have to acknowledge that and, you know, deliver into that sort of ecosystem. And if they don't want to do that, then they won't buy the club then.
You've spoken then about many of the challenges. What do you think is the major challenge facing football in the coming decade?
Yeah, it's several. You know, first of all, football is, you know, the biggest sport in the world. It also has a lot of possibilities. You know, it is a success story, football. You know, as you know, I know about your podcast also being here forever, and you know, football is, you know, a wave, and it's never gonna go away. You know, it is a language that, you know, is so beautiful, and it can never be cliches. You know, football is played when wars are still happening. You know, so I do think it's also gonna be very big part of the solution the next decade. I think it will be more and more important to have these arenas where people meet, you know, but we also face big challenges. You see, we have dropping participation numbers, for example, with the grassroots, not just because of geopolitical stress or, you know, money at the top, or it's also, you know, with gaming and a change of behavior and cost living crisis, not to say the least. So I think this is one of the most important fights we all have to take, is to have the trend line that is a bit negative now to go upwards again. Football needs to grow. It's a movement that needs a lot of players, a lot of engagement. So I think that we have to realize that also the pandemic sort of escalated that a bit. So that is one very big and an important thing. And then, of course, football being the big sport it is and so close to, you know, all states, I think the geopolitical stress that we see, not just with Russia and Belarus, but all over the world, and this deglobalization will affect football. It will be tempting to be, you know, boycott this, boycott that, or sort of, you know, burn bridges. But football should connect people. It should never be something empty leaders say. This is, you know, what it actually should do. So that will be a very big challenge, to uphold the power of connecting people when cost of living is going to be rising, the participation numbers going a bit down, and the pressure to disconnect with countries will go high, you know, from audiences. So in all this, I think it's very important to keep the eye on the ball, to use a very simple metaphor, that we try to stay on the field and you know, limit our responsibility to protect the game and the players.
One challenge from the governing body perspective is that fans' trust in major governing bodies is very low, right? And one of the things that we've seen about that recently is the report into the treatment of Liverpool fans at last year's Champions League final. How do you restore the trust of the fans in something that is quite nebulous, you know, a governing body. It doesn't really have a personality that you can get on board with.
Yeah, no, it is, you know, to be the governing body of football, which is, you know, the stakeholder is so strong and it's own everywhere, so nobody really wants to be ruled, but somebody has to rule. So it's not a place where you become very popular. So it's that is the starting point. So it's difficult, but of course we need trust. It's different, you know. One thing is to have opposition, and another thing is to be despised, you know. So because then you will have poison, a poisonous environment is not good. So of course trust needs to be there, and I don't have the answers to that, but I only have one, and it's transparency. You know, transparency drives behavior. To have a system, a culture, attitude of, you know, talking about the dilemmas. Be very outspoken of, you know, this is a difficult thing, and also handle, you know, it is difficult to be leader in a football body because media is very close to us, you know, and media, you know, the narrative is that it's something wrong with the governing body. So I do think it's very easy to shut down and then to be a protective environment and think that media will only get you and try to get you and take you down. And in many cases, media won't conflict. So it does not help when you're transparent and you just get, you know, the headlines where the small against the big, you know, the narrative is always given. So I think it is difficult to be very transparent as a leader in football, but it's necessary that we are. Of course, quality is always the biggest thing to deliver. If you have more and more Champions League finals like the one in Paris, of course, trust will disappear because it was dangerous. I was there. And it is easier for everyone to go into the shell and to build a, you know, fort outside. But in the end, it will not be easier, I think. So to me, transparency drives behavior. And it's one of the big things when we go into a decade of big challenges. I think it's very important that we feel confident and fearless in speaking openly about the challenges we have to solve.
And the reason that you're still going to keep taking this on and keep fighting for this is because you love football?
Yeah,
This is worth it.
Yeah. It's a motivation thing. It's of course also something I feel safe in my own country. It's asked from me. People demand transparency. I was elected on it. I also have the feeling that what do I have to lose? You know, I was never a politician. I never dreamt of becoming, you know. So it's a freedom in the feeling that the change in itself and the contribution I will want to give is bigger than any ambition I have. You know what I mean? I came from the sport. I'm a lawyer. I've never been elected to anything before. So of course this is also something I. Emotionally, it's always you always have something to lose. You know, it's never good to feel that you're exposing a culture or being viewed upon as a difficult, you know, person or that you expose good colleagues or and it always have to be with respect. So emotionally, it's difficult, but rationally, I think, okay, then I can run, you know, this part of the run.
Yes. Last thing. Do you feel like your style of play? How far do you feel your way of playing as a footballer informs your style of leadership and the way you are in business?
Yeah, it's a good question actually, and I never thought of it. But maybe we are different personalities, and of course, I also on the field had my style of play. You know, I was you know a number 10 player. I wanted creativity. I wanted change in energy, and I did not really stick in just one position. I went, you know, where I found the room. So, and I was very intense. Also, I wanted to affect the game, and I wanted to build the team. So, and a very very passionate player. So, you know, to every game was, you know, the most important thing ever. So. So maybe, you know, it's also a personality thing.
Exciting to think of you bringing that to every single meeting, and slightly terrifying as well, Lisa.
Yeah, well, you know, I had some years in, you know, as a judge, you know, with, you know, the cloth on where you have to sit quiet for days and days. So I've had some detoxing since my career. But, you know, and then, you know, the love for the game and the feeling that you have to risk something to win something, I guess. And also the experience of, you can always rise after a defeat. You know, it's important things for me from the playing days.
Thank you so much for speaking to The Drop-In, and very best of luck with ruffling all the feathers and having all the conversations.
Ruffling the feathers, yeah. It's a good one.
So that was Lisa Klavanas from Rwanda, where she's at the FIFA conference. Found her so interesting to talk to, just someone who's on the one hand kind of at the heart of things, you know, she runs an FA, but on the other hand, really still outside the main corridors of power, if you like, within football. And it's quite exciting to think what would happen if she did have a seat at that UEFA table. We've got so many more guests coming for you in the next few weeks on The Drop-In, so we really hope you'll join us for those as well. Do remember to get in touch and tell us what you thought about our conversation with Lisa. It's on Twitter, it's at Football Ramble, or you can find me on Twitter and on Instagram at KVL Mason. And I'll catch up with you guys very, very soon. Take care.
The Football Ramble is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with something, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.